Oh, do I have a moderator on the call again?
Yes. Hi, Rabbi Harris. This is Yaakov. How are you?
Oh, Yaakov, it's so nice to hear your voice. How you doing?
Yes, thank you for joining us for the third part of the series. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Oh, it's my honor. Really, it's my honor. Just tell me, remind me, Yaakov, there was something I think you told me to do last week to help Mike. You'll just keep me posted if my voice is clear or not, okay? Last time I think there was an issue at one point.
Yeah, just make sure to speak into the phone without moving away from it.
And how's this? Is this coming out
okay?
Yeah,
this is fine. Yeah, this is great.
Okay, great. Okay, good. So if I'm not mistaken, we're going to wait a few minutes, right, to just allow people to join if they're joining live? Or what, you tell me.
Yeah, that's fine. We can wait a few minutes if you want.
Sure. Well, the truth is that, you know what, if there's somebody on the call now while we're just waiting, it's always of interest to me to just kind of hear if people have a it's helpful for me to hear what people are hearing, if they're hearing something, if they're seeing something, if something from what I've shared the last couple of weeks with David Chaim's guest call and then last week, you know, this is a little bit of a, it's in many ways probably not new, but maybe there is something new. I'd like to hear if somebody has a thought or a comment or a question.
Hey, hi, Chaim G7 here. The truth of the matter is for the past last week and 2 weeks ago, although I've heard you, but I wasn't really there, even though I was listening to you, I'm kind of like coming out of a fog. I hope it goes stack and it keeps on going. But I heard ideas and I just, you know, so I'm just back to hopefully get back into reality.
Great. You know, did you hear the comment that I, the Shtickel Torah that I shared, the Midrash regarding Adam Arishon's first night on planet Earth a couple weeks ago?
I don't remember it.
The basic idea is that, you know, when the night start, when the sun set and nightfall fell, his conclusion was that the world was ending, and he began to freak out. Like he was, you know, the world is ending and I caused it. So he spent the night crying and fasting. You know, he and Chava were just, you know, they were terrified. They were terrorized. And then, lo and behold, the sun rises, and they, you know, and the Midrash says that what he concluded was Minhago Shel Olam Hi. So, you know, my take on this is that on the simple level, he understood that the sun sets and rises, right? That's the Minhago Shel Olam. But I think on a deeper level, Minhago Shel Olam is that a person can come to see and experience the world in a way that looks, you know, it just looks so clearly the way, like, you know, it looks the way it looks. But then he comes to recognize that he's literally not seeing reality. You know, he doesn't, like, it's Minhago Shel Olam that a human being can get lost in his own perception, in his own thinking. And it's my experience that, you know, the yesod for me of this learning experience is that there's something magical that happens when a person can kind of find some acceptance for the human capacity to get lost and to make mistakes. You know, when we can, and that's a gift. You know, I like, we can understand that idea. We can understand it as an idea, as an intellectual, beautiful thing. But when a person gets a glimpse of that from the inside, you know, that, you know what, it's like, it's wow, it's like, it is really human to do this. There's something magical happens when a person sees that, and there's an acceptance. It's amazing what can quiet down and how we can get out, we can start to be open to something new. You know, new thoughts can come our way. And anybody who gets into a fog and then gets troubled by the fact that they got into a fog, like all of that is, what my understanding, it's Minhago Shel Olam. You know, it's like literally, we're just trying to, we're human beings who are, we were, the way that Hashem designed this world, that we are regularly going to get, we're going to get lost. Now, that doesn't mean that we are hopeless, God forbid, but that we have an understanding that it's normal to see and feel the world in a way that's kind of, crumb. And then to realize that, to give ourselves a break about it, you know, like that, to me, that's a large part of this, you know, going into a fog and then kind of realizing how human it is to go into a fog.
I just wanted to comment. You hear me, Rabbi Harris?
Yeah, I do. Yaakov, is that you?
Yeah. I just wanted to comment that I see, you know, certain parallels between the innate health and the 12-step program, at least as far as the fact that we're not our thoughts. And that's basically the aside of innate health. You know, we experience our thoughts, but we aren't our thoughts. And the same thing in the 12-step program, where we sort of learn to recognize that we are addicts and we have certain pathways ingrained in our brain that make us think certain ways. It's not us. In other words, we're not bad people who need to get good. We're sick and we need to get well. And we sort of learn to view the addiction from the outside, and when we get the kind of addictive thought patterns, we just call it, you know, stinking thinking, and we recognize it for what it is, and we can chuckle at ourselves and say, you know, there I go again, that's the addictive thinking, it's not me. It's sort of recognizing the, you know, the thoughts as something external. And the 12-step program gives us tools when we you know, to deal with that, which the innate health program might not give us the same tools, but the aside of both of them are the same, and they're coming from the same hanacha, you know. Absolutely.
Yeah. I would say, you know, and even the concept of tools, you know, some folks who start to learn about the principles of innate health start to kind of see that there's really no there's no prescription or form to the principles in what they're understanding. You know, it's really kind of a description of what is happening as opposed to a prescription for what to do. But the premise is that there are plenty of good things to do out there. It's just that we're going to be well served to appreciate that even a good form can be used as a from a vantage point, from a way of thinking that is itself compromised. You know, it's interesting how, you know, even doing a good deed, or let's not talk about action so much. Let's talk about, you know, following a certain train of thought can seem on the outside to be a highly responsible thing. But if the premise behind it is based in insecure thought, then it's going to show up in the world of action, in not just the world of action, in my own, it's going to come to life. You know, I don't know if people realize, I shared the midrash about you know, the midrash that quotes the pasuk about don't grab onto the ears of a passing dog.
Right.
It's spoken about Yaakov Avinu and his efforts to prepare for his encounter with Esav. I was astonished. Midrash basically, you know, takes Yaakov to task for undertaking the whole preparation that he did. Now, I'm not, God forbid, stepping in as the judge. I'm just saying what the Midrash says. The Midrash says that, you know, he Esav was hoylech ledarko. Esav was going on his way, and he took what would seem to be such, you know, basic responsible efforts, prayer, you know, doron, appeasement, melchama, practical strategy, and yet apparently the premise of his whole approach was based on on an insecure thought. It was a fearfulness, and fearfulness is something that if there's a real perception of a fearful nature, then you know that the nature of that perception is colored by a different type of thinking. You know, so there's all kinds of beautiful actions or steps to take, but we would want to be mindful of seeing what's our state of mind as we contemplate. You know, you can apologize to somebody from a really calm and peaceful, generous state of mind, or you could apologize to somebody from a somewhat resentful and insecure state of mind. Obviously, apology is a good thing to do, but it's helpful to see what is operating, just to notice what's operating, and it's not complicated because you can feel it. It doesn't, it's not about analyzing even. It's just sensing the presence of thinking that's happening at all times.
Right. I mean, knowledge is half the solution. You know, once you understand that you're not your thoughts and that you're just experiencing them.
Beautiful.
That's already half of the, solution, especially when it comes to addiction, of being able to step back and just kind of
laugh at it. That's right. And, we shouldn't be, right. The very sense, that people have, what a breath, what a relief it is to have a sense that I'm not really needing to solve this thinking, I don't need to make the thinking disappear or to dissolve it or to overcome it. Like, I mean, how common is that in the world of, as I see it, there isn't a person in the world. My understanding of addiction is behaviors that people do as a way of relieving themselves from unpleasant feelings, and those can take the shape, the form of all kinds of things, whether it's, procrastinating or not managing finances properly or whatever it is, there's all kinds of habits that we have that are, that we get intimidated, we get frightened by really what comes down to our thinking.
Right.
That's what happens. We get frightened by our thinking, and then in innocently thinking that we're going to, we need to manage or deal with the frightening thought, we then end up engaging something that is, a rabbit hole.
As they say in the White Book, the only way we think we can be free of it is to do it. And that's not true. We just have to let it go, let it walk by.
Beautiful. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And yeah. So I wanted to kind of do here's what I wanted to do right now. Some of it I want to share. I want to kind of do a quick review of some of the principles that we've shared and some of the underlying premises. And then I'd like to check in. And then based on where the check-in goes, if there's comments, questions, then I'd like to develop a few other thoughts. Now, Yaakov, it might be, I'm not sure if there's a mute option, but I'm hearing some background noise.
Yes, I'll mute.
Okay, good. Okay, great. So let's just do a little bit of a review. We're talking about the principles of innate health, which is one understanding of, something that it's one way of understanding a little bit behind what's already happening in the world. The way I refer to a principle is the way that we might refer to gravity. Gravity is not something that some people who will learn about the principles of innate health might ask at a certain point, I'm not really sure that I'm doing the principles very effectively. I'm not sure if I'm using them well. And there's a bit of a misnomer there because you don't really learn to use them. You don't really learn to apply them. Rather, you open up to the truth that they're already working. the same way that gravity's working. You know, you don't need to learn how to use gravity. You don't even need to understand. You don't even need to know that there's a gravity in play, that to be living in gravity, because it's just what we're living in. And this is true about these principles. They're just descriptions of what's already in play. That the nature of our experience is, despite it looking like it's coming kind of, you know, from the outside in, that events can and circumstances in our lives can, you know, can arouse all kinds of reactions or feelings, or, you know, our past can be kind of the cause of our present. The truth is that our moment, our experience of life at all times, and at any moment in time, and at every moment in time, is really an experience of our thinking. And by thinking, I don't mean necessarily the cognizant kind of conscious thinking that you and I are doing. In other words, if I were to, you know, I could do a thought exercise with folks in which I would say, you know, list for me 10 things that you did today, you know, and you could then, you know, put your mind in motion to come up with a list of, well, I got out of bed, and then I did Nagelwasser, and then I did this, and that. You know, you could come up with that list, and that would be an aspect of thought that you and I have access to. But it's safe to say that we all have, and we have some appreciation for the fact that thinking is occurring far beyond just our cognizant conscious effort to think. There's a flow of thinking that every human being is experiencing at all times. Now, the way that our experience occurs, the way that we feel, the way we feel, is because there's a special light that we have called the gift of consciousness that enables us to feel our thinking, such that if we have a thought of a if a thought comes to us of kind of a warm and compassionate nature, you know, you could hear a song that touches you, that you have a memory from that song of a, you know, of something or who knows what, and it can arouse in you a really warm and deep feeling. Well, that deep feeling, that warm and deep feeling, is made possible because there was some kind of a special soft, expansive thought, the idea of that there's thoughts that when we feel them, when we feel the warm, deep feeling that we feel, it's because we've had an experience of paying attention to a soft and warm, expansive thought. And alternatively, when we get stressed, like if we open up a bill from the mail and it shows us that we're, you know, closer to the, you know, $0 limit in our checking account than we thought, and we get stressed. So it looks obviously like it's a circumstance, but the actual feeling that we have is only attributable to the quality of the thought that is occurring in our mind. And of course, this happens quickly. It doesn't happen in a way that we're necessarily conscious of. We would refer to that as the visibility or the invisibility of thought. Sometimes our thinking is not visible to us. We're walking around living in a feeling of stress, or living in a feeling of resentment, or alternatively living in a feeling of clarity and blessing. And we might attribute it to all kinds of things. But the short answer as to what it can be attributed to is the quality of thought that's passing through us. The gift of thought that is kind of a somewhat spiritual and mysterious phenomenon, that we're all having a certain, you know, kind of stream of consciousness that is occurring. And so right now I've just simply described two of the three principles, one being the concept of thought, that all experience is made up of thought, that there's thinking going through us all the time, and that consciousness is what allows us to feel that, and that anything that we are feeling, we can kind of back into the idea, working kind of backwards. Anything we're feeling, we can see it's really an experience, a feeling of our thinking. And then the other three of the three principles, which really unites and kind of is the oneness of all the principles, is the idea of the divine, the divine mind, the intelligence, the formless and the formless intelligence that's behind all of life, that is what is. We're all living in that intelligence, and there's really nothing other than that intelligence and the possibility of thought unfolding moment to moment that shows up in my mind, both the insecure thoughts that I have as well as the peaceful, expansive thoughts. In God's wisdom, he saw fit to make available to us a whole variety of thought, as well as the power of consciousness that enables us to feel our thinking. And the beauty of all of this is that we can see and we can sense kind of the non-personal nature of our experience. You know, the degree to which it's just not such a commentary about me or my, you know, capacities. If to the degree that I'm I'm struggling or I'm not struggling. More than it's a commentary about my madriga or what I'm doing, you know, well or not well, it's a commentary about this gift of thought that is moment to moment unfolding from a spiritual source, and that can is something new. You know, there's new thought showing up moment to moment. So. That's what enables us to appreciate, you know, when David HaMelech says, Esa einai el heharim, I lift up my eyes to the mountains, me'ayin yavo ezri, from where does my help come? So on a simple level, me'ayin yavo ezri, from where does my help come? On a deeper level, me'ayin is from the nothingness. There's what do I have already except I don't have the new thoughts are showing up moment to moment, and I don't really control the source of thought. I can experience and be open to and rely on, and we certainly know that our trust in that, our deeper appreciation for the reliability of this this whole gift, it certainly can slow us down, settle us down, and with a trusting nature, it only draws us closer and closer to an experience of God showing up in our lives. You know, God's expressing himself in our consciousness and in our moment-to-moment thought. So that's kind of a summary of, the principles. And I, if it's okay with you, Yaakov, maybe we'll unmute and just I'd like to see if there's some comments or questions that people have about that. Before we go into kind of what's next,
everybody can unmute themselves. One second, I'll unmute everyone automatically. All right.
Okay, so anybody.
So what are the three principles? Just if you could put them into three sentences, each one.
Sure.
There's three principles, right?
Yeah, three principles are thought, consciousness, divine mind.
Thought.
Those are the three. Yeah, thought. The phenomenon that there is, you know, that there is that. Thinking is what is unfolding, you know, moment to moment in our experience. You can't be alive and not experience thinking passing through your head, and you're not managing that. You can't stop thoughts from showing up. You can't pull the thoughts exactly as you want them to show up. It's true, you can, you know, review your grocery list and come up with those thoughts, but to access thought in the manner that, you know, the thought is kind of a given. It's just part of the gravity of the nature of life. And then consciousness is the capacity that we have ongoingly to feel our thinking. It's that light that illuminates a thought that brings it to life in a way that it just feels so real. And then divine mind is the source, the fact that, you know, thoughts are coming from somewhere. Where are they coming from? What accounts for our shifts in mood? You know, I have moods. I see that. I see it, you know, I see that I get into, I have one way of reacting to my wife on certain days, and then the same things that she might do, you know, a day or an hour later, it'll just show, it'll register so differently for me. And it's just like, well, what accounts for that? You know, what allows
right.
there to be a different feeling state despite the common set of circumstances? That's what we're pointing to, that there's this kind of unfolding. You know, so those are the three pieces of one kind of puzzle behind what makes our experience flow.
Uh-huh. And understanding these three principles is supposed to give us what?
Well, here's how I see it. You know, when I understand what's behind my experience, I'm much less likely to be personally reactive to it in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when I'm,
so that,
and when I'm, yeah.
Yeah, that basically sums it up, and that's why it can help for addiction, pretty much, because, you know, we react to our thoughts and feelings by medicating and self,
yes.
you know, soothing,
yes.
and we don't need to. Once we understand the process of thought and that we're not our thoughts and how it works and where our moods are coming from, you know, from the divine
right.
mind.
That's right.
And
the
thoughts
you know,
are just like gravity. They just happen, you know, and it doesn't make us, it doesn't define us. So, yeah, that,
correct.
That makes
yeah,
a lot
and
of
what's
sense.
Beautiful, what's beautiful about this is that even the capacity to see this insightfully is not something that we do. To see this insightfully, to see this from kind of an inner, you know, direction is something that we somehow wake up to. It's you know, to me, my appreciation of the kind of the mystery of free will has deepened, you know, like, I'm a little more cognizant of the fact that I'm not in control of my life as maybe I'd like to think. Not in a way that I'm now abdicating responsibility, but I'm, you know, just kind of sitting, I'm more inclined to just stand back one step and be, you know, less jumping into the fray. You know, I'm kind of watching a little bit more than I am reacting.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. Okay, so maybe go on if you have more
okay,
thoughts
great.
To share.
Okay, great. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So you know, one way of understanding addictive behaviors is, as I said, it's a way of, you know, it's what people do it's what people do to relieve themselves of unhappy feelings. And, you know, you can't, it's like, it's hard to really fault somebody in an unhappy state of mind without a certain perspective or a certain perception of it being an unhappy state. There is a temporary release in an addictive behavior. There's no question about it. And it's hard to really fault the guy when he's, you know, when we're so wired to seek relief, we're so wired to seek a certain, you know, relief from distress, when there is a behavior that can medicate us, it's kind of, you know, it's like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And our capacity to understand the source of our unhappy feelings, of course, is what enables us to see it in a way that it just no longer looks. You know, here's a metaphor that someone shared. You know, imagine you have a child that awakens in the middle of the night from a nightmare, and he's crying and he's calling, and you know, you come into the room, and the child is terrified, and he's, you know, crying, and you say, "What's the matter?" And he says, "There's a monster in the room," you know. And lo and behold, he points in the direction of the window, and guess what? The shadows with the moonlight and the objects in the room, it actually kind of could look like there is a figure that's, you know, kind of ominous looking. Like you could see it. You could see where the kid, you know, kind of concluded that there's some kind of a moving, you know, the breeze on the trees, etc. So you see it and you're kind of like, wow, there is something there. But obviously, you understand that the source of the perception that there's a monster is a little bit different, you know, than what he's seeing. Now, for the kid, the nature of his experience is so compelling that there's a very limited bandwidth of choices that he could view as appropriate responses. You know, one option is to hide under the covers, another option is to run, and you know, like there's X number of options that are reasonable responses to that behavior, to that circumstance. But you viewing the circumstances and with the perspective that you have, it would never occur to you to hide under the covers or to run. It just wouldn't, because the nature of your understanding is of a different nature. We're pointing in a direction that allows us to see that there's a profound kind of paradigm shift for what our experience signifies. A highly profound paradigm shift. What does our experience tell us? It's not uncommon that our experience seems to tell us, like I said, about the facts of life and about what's in front of our eyes. And the same way that, you know, when Autumn looked out at the sun setting, it was just like the world is ending, right? And it made sense for him in the face of that occurrence to react in the way that he did. Now, once he understood what he did, the profound nature of what was, you know, new about what was the source of his experience, everything shifted, and it was no longer, it just didn't even make sense to struggle in the way that he might have struggled before. That's what we're looking for. We're looking to be open to this idea of a profound understanding, a shift in what really is, what's behind our experience, what our experience points to, more than the disappearance of the sun was an indication of the world ending. It was an indication of Adam's thinking. It was a wonderful, wonderful indicator about the quality of his thought, and therefore, you know, that's a wow. You know, like I have moment to moment. All I have to do is just kind of notice, even vaguely, without even having to ask myself what's behind this. If I see my feeling state drop, I know that I'm now, you know, even as it looks like I'm in it, the circumstances around me are the source of that, or there's a commentary being, you know, filled in about the circumstances. The only thing that's being revealed is just the quality of my thinking in the moment, and that gives me a potential for, you know, just a different kind of. I'm an eyewitness. I'm really just an eyewitness to this unfolding of a spiritual reality.
It's a good muscle, like the parent. In a certain sense, it's just a more mature way of looking at the shadows and at the, you know, we're not a little kid. If we're immature in our perceptions and our thoughts, we will see everything as a monster, you know, but if we look at it from the outside, as with this mature way of looking at it, you know, we know there's nothing to run from, and we know that it's really just all coming from the, you know, the divine mind.
That's right. And you know what's fascinating to me about this is that the first time I had a meaningful insight, meaning where I could see more clearly the degree to which my experience is coming to me from my thinking, rather than coming to me from my, you know, circumstances. I don't remember if I shared the story. I was sitting with this gentleman, and he kind of noticed my mood lift, and I had been struggling with, tell me what to do, you know, tell me what to do to incorporate these principles. And at a certain point, he saw my mood lift, and he simply asked me, you know, he asked me, what are you feeling, and, you know, what's going on? And I described the nice feeling I was having and how good it felt. And it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't like I was in this ecstatic state. It was just like I felt nice, you know. And then when he asked me a follow-up question, which was, well, what did you do? You know, what did you do to feel this way? You know, at that moment, I saw like something kind of, I got an insight is what we say. You know, I got a gift of understanding that I saw that the real nature of my experience is coming to me from thought, and that thought itself is something that's spiritual, and it can come to you from beyond you, and that's really the thought that you most want. And it felt lovely. And then immediately following that lovely, warm, and insightful experience, and I could feel myself start to draw inward and get nervous. And the thought that I saw, it's amazing, I saw this as it was unfolding, the thought that accompanied that inward turning in, uneasy feeling was, well, you know, this is great, sitting in this guy's living room in a quiet space with, you know, just he and I talking, but in an hour from now, I'm going to go home, and there's going to be kids and chaos and my wife and, you know, and that kind of thing. And I'm going to go back into my kind of agitated, upset feeling, which I don't like. And then what is this going to do for me? You know, how is that going to help? Like, and you know what? The following, then what was amazing was that another thought came to me. And I didn't manage the thought. I didn't, you know, it just kind of, I saw it bubble forth. And the thought basically said, you know what? You don't know what's going to be in an hour from now. And that is the nature of this world that we live in. That's kind of the way it, apparently the design of life is, that you're not at the driver's, you know, you're not really in the driver's seat. You have a certain, yeah, you definitely have a say, but you can't hoard nice thinking. You can't grasp it. Let's say a person gets a nice feeling. Let's say they get a nice thought and they feel settled and calm and they appreciate that this is a gift. And then maybe right away, they, like myself, they'll become concerned. But how am I going to hold on to this? And what happens if I go back into an insecure state, and from that place of, you know, of sadness or upset, maybe I'll act out again. Maybe I'll betray, you know, what I've been trying to develop. And that would be normal. And what's interesting is that to me, that's another stage of, you know, that's like another implication of this understanding, is that not only is it not possible to kind of stay, you know, to kind of forcibly keep yourself in a high state or in a nice feeling state, it's not really necessary to, because that's kind of the trust that Hashem is drawing us toward. You know, he's really drawing us toward a recognition of our lack of control and our understanding and acceptance of our lack of control. And the beauty of it is that the degree to which we kind of see that I don't need there to be sunny skies all the time, I'm less likely to get triggered. I'm less likely to be judgmental of having this cloudy sky. And then the whole thing kind of, you know, there will never be a point where a person, in my understanding, there'll never be a point where a person can fully insulate himself from insecure thought and from the feelings that go along with that. But what is possible is for a person to have a new experience, a new paradigm, a new relationship with the whole phenomenon of insecure thought and the feelings that accompany them. And just, you know, the acceptance, compassion, the appreciation of the humanity that entails, and the zero stigma associated with having the phenomenon of those thoughts and feelings. Shall we go forward if there's any other comments or questions on
Yeah, sure, go on.
Okay. So, you know, one of the ideas that I find that has, you know, drawn me into a you know, an appreciation of this, it deepened for me a little bit of a sense of the bitachon that I was kind of talking about just now. You know, I mentioned on a prior call, I believe I sometimes get confused between the different calls that I'm doing where I mentioned what source. I believe I referred to the midrash that speaks of the idea that Lo nitna Torah ledarsha ela la'ich leman. The Torah is meant to be understood by those who eat man. And our sages explain that this is not literally that it's referring to the generation, you know, exclusively the generation that lived in the desert, right? It can't be that that's the Torah. The Torah is eternal. The Torah is today. You know, the Torah is something that we're living with and learning and receiving today. Yet we see that there's a premise behind the understanding of Torah, that the expansiveness of Torah, the gift of Torah, that wisdom that is beyond it's the infinite wisdom. There's something, there's a premise behind the ability to interact with and engage and be touched by that wisdom that is in sync with Eichleman. And what were Eichleman? Eichleman were people who understood that they don't generate the basis of their sustenance, and they don't control the basis of their sustenance, and they don't really have the ability to hoard. They're going to get what they need when they need it, on the terms that they need it, as devised by an infinite intelligence that's greater than their own. And in some ways, for me, this is exactly how I view the premise behind my understanding. You know, my expansive thought. I view expansive thought as even more precious than money in the bank. You know, I mean, with understanding, with archavas adas, what can a person do with archavas adas? You know, you can have shalom bayis with archavas adas. You can have beautiful chinuch bonim with archavas adas. You can learn Torah and keep mitzvahs. Archavas adas is you know, the menuchas hanefesh, whatever the words we might use, that expansive understanding, that thinking, that gift of understanding is, you know, so precious. And yet, I don't really, to me, I see parallel to the mountain. I know that I'll get what I need, where I need it, when I need it. I trust in that. I don't, by the way, I don't make my I don't make Siddharim and learning Torah conditional on having Archavas Adas, because it used to be, by the way, it used to be that I could get pretty tied up in, if I sat down to learn Gemara and I found myself to be distracted and busy in my head such that I couldn't follow the Shaka Vatari, I couldn't hold cup with my Chavrusa, or I just, even in my own Chazorah, if I were by myself, you know, it would certainly be the case that within a few minutes, if I didn't feel that if I didn't feel settled, I would be inclined to want to close the Gemara, because like, it's just, who wants to face a feeling of failure? Who wants to face a feeling of not, of breaking, of hitting his head against the wall and not getting anywhere? And so I would give up, you know, but my understanding now is that whatever it is that I'm doing, certainly a peaceful mind and a you know, a broad state of awareness is certainly the blessing that I desire and I pray for. But I realize that nothing's really conditional on that. I don't need the sunny sky in order to engage. A mitzvah is a mitzvah. I can do a mitzvah mitzvah. I can do a dibor. I can do whatever it is that I'm commanded in, I can do it, and I can know that in that moment, whether I feel it or I don't, because I know that there's a magic behind it, I'm present. I see that I'm more capable and more often being present to the mystery and the magic of fulfilling the Ratzon Abore. I love it when I feel, in, you know, warm and fuzzy about it, when I step into tefillah or learning and I feel just Kanakim, but I'm less concerned about it. I'm less dependent on it. And to me, this is the understanding that we're looking for. The Oichle Aman, that life is still operating on Aman principle. It's certainly in Parnassa, it doesn't look that way because we live in a world where there's more Teva. But it's still the case that we live in a world where Mana is the rule. That our Ishtabas are Ishtabas. The results is, you know, is not our Ishtabas. And like Winston Churchill said, you know, success is going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. Right? The more I'm appreciative of the implications of my feeling state. My feelings is the implications of that are, again, this kind of non-personal fact of flow of thought, you know. The more I'm aware of the implications of that, the less it's front page news. The less it's compelling and significant to me, the more it kind of takes on a little bit of a background noise. And then, fascinatingly, it moves. When Shlomo Melech said Gamze Yavor, I don't think he was talking about the circumstances alone in life. He was talking about the state of mind that we're all going through. When we become less interested in our state of mind, our states of mind move. They're fluid, and we will the Almighty will present us the mun that we need, where we need it, when we need it. Whatever that mun is, the mun being anything from our parnasa to our understanding to our clear mind. That's the opportunity in seeing the non-personal nature of this, and then letting go. To follow up with that idea, you know, another way of my experiencing, you know, a metaphor that occurs to me that I used to that kind of describes my experience. I used to live in Manhattan, and at a certain point, we discovered that we had mice issues in our apartment in Manhattan. And I don't know if anybody's ever had the experience of finding rodents living in their living space, but I personally found it to be extremely unsettling. Like, I just, whenever I would open a door and then I'd see something out of the corner of my eye dart into a, you know, corner, it just, my whole body would fill with this feeling of like yuck, disgust, you know, and I'd see the droppings. It was just really unpleasant, and I would get angry. I would get like angry that I was powerless to change this. Now, it's funny because on other occasions I lived near a park in Manhattan where there were also rodents, and sometimes out of the corner of my eye I'd see something scurry along the gutter, the curb, and then jump down into a gutter. And in the for the moment that I'd see that, my body would also go through this like involuntary shudder of yuck, you know, like a disgusting feeling. But what struck me as I began to see as a metaphor when I learned about these principles is that there was a difference between my feeling about the rodent in the park versus my feeling about the rodent in my house. I would feel the momentary yuck of the park experience, but relatively soon afterwards, it would kind of settle down, and I wouldn't dwell on it. It wouldn't linger in the same way as at my home. And to me, this is a little bit the what's going on with a new way of experiencing my thinking. Before I had a little bit of understanding about these principles, my experience moment to moment was like my house. It was my home. I lived in my thinking, but I didn't notice that I lived in my thinking. I was just living there. I was living in my thinking. And so when an unpleasant thought would show up and I would feel insecure or agitated, it felt to me like the rodent was in my house. Like, where am I going to, like, this is my home. Where am I going to go? You know, like, it's really, really upsetting to me that the rodent is in my house, because where am I going to go? This is my home, right? And that's how it used to be when I would get into a foul mood. Again, I didn't notice it as a foul mood at the time. It looked to me like I was upset about the circumstances that I was upset about. I would not only be upset about the circumstances, but I would be very troubled by the very phenomenon of being in a low state, being in an upset mood. Because, look, when all you have is your state of mind, when all you have is your, you know, when you're living in your thinking and not noticing that you're living in your thinking, any unpleasant thought feels really, really unpleasant, you know? And it's like, when am I going to get out of this? When are these mice going to get out of my house? I can't bear it. Now, Today, it looks a little bit differently to me because now it feels more like it's more like the park rodents. Like, when I go into a low state now, it's kind of like I see the rat and it's running along the gutter and I get the heebie-jeebies from it. But at a certain point, I realize, you know, this isn't my home. Like, if I'm in a low state right now, it just means that I'm not really in my home. I'm out somewhere. I'm a little lost. I'm a little bit out there somewhere in a low state. I don't know where and when and how, but at some point I'm going to get home. I have a home that is not rodent infested. And that feeling, now I can get the rodent, you know, I can see the rodents of my insecure, I get the insecure thoughts come my way, and it catches me usually. But at some point, I realized, wait a second, I'm just not home right now, that's all. I'm in the subway platform. Like, so what that in the subway platform I see a rat running along the subway platform? Like, I don't need to get bothered by that so much, because in another 15 minutes, I'm not going to be in the subway platform, or in an hour from now, whatever it is. Today, my experience of my low moods and my low thought, they still show up, and they still catch me. But I see, like, so what? I have a home. It's somewhere, and I'm going to get there in an hour, in a day, in a week. Who knows when? But my home is my home.
Yeah, that's a nice analogy.
So, you know, I'm not sure if I have a whole lot more to share in terms of metaphors and principles. I think we kind of covered a lot, and I'd love if people, if anyone has additional comments or questions, I'd love to hear it. If anybody wants to chime in while I'm making a few announcements, then please do. But I'm just going to say, first of all, I want to just say that to me, you know, the work that people on this call are listening to this recording, the work that folks are doing in this direction, you know, to me, this is the work of tshuva. You know, and as I shared when I first had a couple minutes on David Chaim's call before my guest talk, you know, the Gemara tells us that in Menachos that the reason the letter Hey is associated with tshuva is because it's got a doorway on the bottom, people can fall out of this world, and the reason why it's got an opening on the side is because people can go back in. And the Gemara asks, you know, why not just go back up the way you came? And the answer the Gemara gives is, lo mistayu milsa, it's not going to work that way. You can't go back the way you came. You got to go to a new direction. And that's, we can't find new midos, we can't find new thought, we can't find a new path in this world through the same hard work or efforts that we applied that got us into the problem in the first place. It's about opening ourselves opening up to a new direction and opening up to the necessity of Siddhartha Dishmaya. And to me, as I shared, you know, the understanding of how much already is working, how much the blessing of life and the health of life is in place, you know, it's the heavy lifting is not ours. It's looking in the direction of the source of it all, and seeing how we are kind of through our own thoughts getting a little bit lost. You know, that's in my opinion, that's the work of this generation. And the people who are listening in on this and are working at this, as much as it might look at times to be that maybe they're like stuck in, you know, on the side of the road or discouraged by the fact that they've got some bad habits, I would like to just share that Ein divrei Torah niknin ela lemisha nikshelbam. This understanding is acquired most profoundly by folks who fall in them, and I have no question. I feel that people who fall down and have a deeper appreciation of the need for tshuva and the siyata d'shmaya that is of necessity a part of that. I personally feel that we are ambassadors. We are ambassadors that have been. The hashkacha is this. Okay, I'm not suggesting that there isn't some kind of a cheshbon that, you know, we should be concerned about, you know, about the Almighty's cheshbon, but to appreciate that in the larger hashkacha, there is a hashkacha. There is a degree to which we've been chosen to do an avoda, to be ambassadors for an understanding of what it means to look in a new direction. There is no tshuva without looking in a new direction, and it's not simple. We get in our way. Kochi Voitzim Yadi is a real challenge, and the opportunity to be humbled by the nature of these challenges is such an opportunity to steig in an area of avoda that the Jewish people need. So I just want to express my gratitude to be able to join in and to share some thoughts in my own experience, and to be mitzvahed to a group that is really engaging in holy stuff, and I'm deeply touched and inspired by the fact that there are these folks that you guys are, that there's such an olam of people that are steig in this area. I want to remind folks, if you're interested to learn more about these principles, that my site, JewishCenterForWellbeing.com, has a number of wonderful videos and testimonials and resources, and that, God willing, in the beginning of January, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th, there will be an in-person conference that will be in the New York area, and it will be accessible by live web stream. We've got over 15 speakers from around the world presenting on all kinds of subjects, including folks who struggled with, who are really, you know, stuck in addictions of various kinds and who are just a beautiful different place today. It's for people who are dealing with shalom bias and chinuch and oh, everything. There's no, you know, it's not one category of people. And I that's it. I just want to express my thanks to David Chaim and to Yaakov and to the whole God Yerais team.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Harris. I'd like to announce on the Chizuk emails this conference in New York. So please send me an email reminder to do that towards the end of December, Mirtz Hashem.
That would be the most perfect time to send it out.
I suppose if it's in January, we should probably send it out a week or two before.
Yeah, okay, great. So
yeah, a week or two before.
Wonderful. I have Chesky's email, Yecheskel Stelzer's, and I have David Chaim's. I don't know if I have yours.
That's fine. You can send it to them. They'll pass it on to me as well.
Beautiful.
You can reach
me
at eyes.guard@gmail.com, eyes.guard@gmail.com. And we also have a page about innate health on our website, actually, and I'm going to put your shiurim. I'm going to put your shiurim there, links to your shiurim and Mitzvah Shem, and we'll put other things there. So people can, the website and other stuff like that. All right, thank you so much. I hope this helps a whole bunch of people, Mirtz Hashem.
Amen. Thank you,
Yaakov. Tizkol Mitzvah. Thank you. Bye-bye.